conditioning and deconditioning process. And God willing, as we do that, then there's a wholeness, there's a greater coherence to it, and it has spaciousness to it. And as we've been talking about since we've been here, that we begin to trust and live in the vertical and not be so preoccupied with the horizontal, which is, am I good enough? Am I Sufi enough? Oh my gosh, I asked Kabir this really dumb question and now I'm going to worry about it for the next, you know, he asked me to bring him something of poetry and I bring him the music instead. I mean, those things seem, you know, and I know Kabir loves me, and yet there's that part of me, that little part of me that goes, oh God, I let him down. How could I do that? That's the part of, and there are bigger things, you know. I mean, that may seem like a small thing, but when you love your sheikh, it's not such a small thing, you know. And so I think in our practice, I think one of the fundamental things that we are gifted with in this practice is an opportunity in a safe space to decondition. Because I don't know of anybody that's sitting here, I'm not including my sheikh, by the way, that doesn't have this conditioning that we're still, that we're still dancing with, that, you know, we're struggling with that. The first part is to have the courage to really look at it. And I think the way to look at where you're conditioned is to look at where you're reactive, to look at where you bristle, to look at where you need to get defensive. That's like a stop sign. And in circles, and I maybe should, as Mahmoud said, keep my mouth shut, but I think it is a place, it's like being in the kitchen. It's a hot place. And what we don't want to see about ourselves, we can almost be guaranteed it's going to come up. And alhamdulillah, but it's that willingness and the courage to stand in the fire with one another. So that's.
Thank you. as you say, conditioning is such a broad subject, and we often talk, and have written about three steps: deconditioning, reconditioning, and unconditioning. And unconditioning is, well, opening to the divine and receiving the inspirations, the grace of the divine, and opening to this vastness of reality. But coming back to the very first area of deconditioning, there too we have a broad field. And let's leave aside for the moment, just for the moment, like for this weekend, the broad social issues. And there are important ones. There are gender, racial, nationalistic issues. That's not really our focus here on this path. It's not that we exclude anything, but we try to focus on the very core issues that have to do with what I'll call the false self and its relationship to our essential self and who we really are. This conversation started last night. And since the spiritual path is about transformation of the self above all, that transformation typically will lead to an examination of the broader areas of social and gender and racial conditioning, etc. But right at our heart are some really core issues. And Mahmoud touched on it, I think, quite accurately when he said it's often a kind of childishness. Mm-hmm. It's an immaturity that is allowed to play out right into adult life and even be justified. We could see our politicians and our leaders and educators and religious leaders often embodying some rather childish things. So just to try to analyze this a little bit and to identify what are some of the attributes of the false self that keep us imprisoned or enslaved, because really this is what we're talking about. We're talking about an enslavement of our hearts and souls to false values. What are the false values of that give birth to these false selves? Does that lead you to anything? Can you?
What came to me is one of the stories of the Mathnawi that we just finished studying in the UK, which is the story of the merchant going to India and the parrot. Because it talks exactly about that, about, you know, the metaphor of the bird, the parrot is us, is the immature self that's enslaved.
Explain that.
Enslaved because of its beautiful voice. You know, its conditioning. You know, I'll get my signature is my voice.
And it's in a cage.
It's put in a cage because of it, right? So that, right? And it becomes a value, something of value, and it's enslaved. Right? And the only way for it to come out of the cage is to die to that quality that endears it to slavery, or to being enslaved, being captured by someone else. I think that's so important to understand, you know, in that story, is that we are selling ourselves to others by our conditioning. You know, because we think we're going to get something. We're going to get approval or attention or importance of some kind. Right? And that's the trap. We're locked up for life.
Good. So let's underline this and maybe put this down as one of the key aspects of conditioning in the false self, the need for others' approval and our willingness to do anything to get that approval, including being dishonest to ourselves or developing certain qualities that we think will win approval from others by pleasing others, but not because pleasing others is a good thing, but because we unconsciously will do anything to get that. You know? So when we're not aware that what we're doing is a game to please others in order to be accepted, loved, or empowered by others. Hadim, what? Anything?
Well, I was looking in the Masnavi, and Rumi has, you know, many things to say about about habits, and he talks about a narrow house and the soul within is cramped. He ruined it in order that he might make a royal palace. I am cramped like the embryo in the womb. I have become 9 months old. This migration has become urgent. Unless the throes of childbirth take over my mother in this prison, I am amidst the fire. So we don't even know that we're in that prison. We don't, you know, we don't see it. We just know the misery of it. And it is through this practice that birthing, that childbirth can happen. But it seems that it takes us also a certain amount of cooking for that to be able to happen. I mean, you mentioned that the younger dervishes, the novices, are in the kitchen. Well, there's fire in the kitchen. There's heat in that kitchen. And you learn the adab, but you learn patience and you learn respect, and you also spend time scrubbing the pots and pans, which is not, you're not allowed into the next step. And even that process, I think, for us, in, you know, can or for myself can be difficult because we want to move ahead. We want the sweetness. We want the we want to sit with those that we think have more than we do. And so there is, there is that greediness there because we think that when we arrive there, we'll have something. We'll be seen. I think everybody wants to be seen. And that's, I think, sometimes the remedy of being seen is to be ignored. Hmm. And that's very painful. Let me just see here. Without the rider, the horse itself is useless. Therefore, train the horse of bad habits, else the horse will be rejected before the king. The horse's eye finds a way from the king's eye. Without the king's eye, its eye is in desperate plight.
Thank you. You know, one of the most fundamental drives of the nafs, the self, is the drive to maximize pleasure and comfort and to avoid discomfort and lack of pleasure. So this is continually driving all of us, and it's related to our survival instincts. We needed to The ego, the nafs, is a survival mechanism. You had to have enough food, you had to have enough of everything to survive. So fundamentally, that's what's going on. But something else happens along the way where we think that the purpose of life itself is to maximize pleasure.
Minimize pain.
What?
And minimize pain.
And minimize pain. Mevlana says that the way to work with the nafs is to challenge it, to take away some of what it wants, not to continually try to satisfy its every need. So we have the practice of fasting, for instance. You know, during Ramadan, we have a good experience of denying the nafs what it naturally wants and has every right to, which is food. But by giving the nafs an experience of this deprivation, which we think is bad, the nafs thinks it's bad, the soul finds out, in fact, it's good. The soul grows as the nafs declines. One of our great Sufis said, if you are at peace with your nafs, you're at war with God. It's an extreme statement, but there is truth in it. So one of the ways on the spiritual path to deal with the nafs is to keep it a little bit unsatisfied. This doesn't mean to kill it. It doesn't mean to deprive it of everything. But if, on the other hand, you're just spending your whole life trying to satisfy every whim and desire of your nafs, you are a slave to a million masters, not just one. Because the nafs has, not only does it have many desires, many of those desires even contradict each other. If you couldn't fulfill them all because one would cancel out another, so it really is a mess. So as a principle, fasting from desire is a fundamental principle. Not obliterating every desire, not thinking we have no right to any desires or to the healthy fulfillment of normal human desires. Our tradition allows that. We're not ascetics. We're not celibates. We're not hermits. But a healthy teasing of the nafs is part of the program. A a playfulness with the nose. You want that? Okay, you're not going to get it. Sorry. You know, could you say that? Could you be awake enough to occasionally say that? And so there are some fundamental drives of the nafs. I'm just pointing to the one, which is pleasure and pain through mostly material satisfactions. But there are a few others that are really important to identify and in a way categorize. So let's add to this, and you touched on it, seeking approval of others. You referred to it too, didn't you? You want. We all want approval. We also want, in something that we see, those of us especially who are responsible for groups, people come, and sometimes, above all, they want validation. People desperately want validation. But then what do we validate in another? Do we validate every whim and desire of their nafs? Or do we validate what is truly essential? If they are craving attention, is it kind to give them attention? If it's the false self that's craving that? How do we work with these things? The work really falls on all of us, on you, on me, on all of us, to work with ourselves and to recognize how that need for approval, validation, and attention is operating. The need for approval is often satisfied by being obedient to authorities. That's a very common social game. Does any real Sufi sheikh want that? Do you think a real Sufi sheikh wants your obedience in that way? No. Do we prize devotion above all else? Yes. When it's coming from a pure heart, it's the most beautiful thing. Frankly, in my eyes, it's the most beautiful thing I see in a human being, is that open-hearted devotion. But occasionally there are people who, God bless them, need to be recognized as a giver, but it's coming from an insufficiency in themselves, and it's just feeding that insufficiency. So sometimes we won't let somebody like that give and serve. We'll say, no, thank you. I don't need that. So we all have to learn how to play with our need for attention, our need for approval, and to tease the nafs. The path, the melami path, the path of melamet, which is the way of blame, is a conscientious, rigorous approach to this, in which the melami, meaning the one on the path of blame, will tease his or her nafs in such a way that rather than trying to appear as better than we are, we go out of our way to accept appearing as less than we are. The last thing a melami will do is try to look good. Everybody else, most of us are trying to look good, trying to look as good as we can. Well, what would it be like to tease that compulsion? Not to offend people and not to do anything truly blameworthy, but to toy with our own attachments, these emotional compulsions, to look good, to be approved of, to gain attention. Everybody wants attention. Nobody wants to be ignored. But the more you want attention, the more you do for it, the more people are going to ignore you. They're going to say, oh. Because of where it's coming from. So one of the principles, I think probably we've experienced this, is that how to give attention to a person in the right way, at the right time, to the right aspect of themselves. Sometimes people are really down on themselves. People are suffering with shame, with their own sense of insufficiency. And then the spiritual friend, the spiritual companion, the brother, sister, dervish, or the sheikh may see the beauty in another. Mm-hmm. And by seeing that beauty and confirming that deep beauty in another, actually bring it out. Which is very different from validating the compulsive need for attention that some people feel and which exhibits itself by the need to continually talk about oneself. Interesting to observe that. How often do we say I? How often do we make our story the center of attention? With maturity, it becomes less important. To gain that validation, to gain attention in that way. So, teasing the self, leaving those aspects of ourself a little bit unsatisfied as a spiritual practice.
I think the malamis, Sufis in general, the teasing can be in this form, which takes courage, is to consciously choose to experience what we're afraid of, you know, which is not depriving the nafs necessarily, but teaching ourselves that we're not going to die if we face it, you know, if we face lack of attention or shame. I mean, in Eastern cultures, shame is such a huge conditioner, in all cultures, but particularly like where I come from, you know, so, you know, shame is such a powerful thing that it's debilitating to try to go away from the norm, you know, and be seen as, you know, you're not doing what you're supposed to do, you're not looking the way you're supposed to look, you're not, etc., etc.
But you have my permission to tell a story about your activities on the streets of London.
Yeah.
So, I was in the subway one time, coming out of the subway, and I was made to move in the opposite direction to run into this guy who was begging, and who, you know, he said, "Oh, I." First he goes, "Are you Muslim?" I said, "Yes." Alhamdulillah. He said, "Brother, I lost my wallet and I need money to get to the airport. My family's out." And I, you know, my mind is going, "Yeah, right, you know, sure." And all this stuff, right? But then I thought, you know, why am I doing this? You know, even if he is lying, is it my place to be judging him if he's lying or not? You know, I literally was walking up one exit and I changed my mind and walked the other way to run into this guy, you know? And I thought there's something in here for me, maybe another illusion. And so I gave him money. I gave him money. And then as I walked away, I thought, well, I didn't give him everything I had. I had 40 pounds in my pocket. I gave him 20. And he goes, "No, I need more." I said, "This is all I can give you." And as I walked away, I thought, why didn't I give him everything? Mm-hmm. You know, why am I always holding back? You know, because in my mind, I know this guy is not real. You know, he's not. I knew it, and later on, I verified it because that's his job. He's always on this platform doing this. So I thought, you know, because this reminded me of something that happened years ago. The same thing where I only gave half. I was given the opportunity to help someone, and I held back. So later that night, as I was about to go to sleep, what I heard before I fell asleep is that, you know, you're still afraid of letting go, and you're still judging people when it's not your place to be judging. And it became clear to me that I had to go and beg on the streets of London. that would be, you know, giving my nafs a taste of something. You know, so I know what it feels like. And for a while I hesitated. I thought this carries great shame, to do that. But then somehow the courage came and I decided I'm going to do it, and I'm going to do it on a street where mostly Middle Easterners are. It's a place called Edgeware Road, so that I would face my own kind. So I did. I got ready and I, wore some really old clothes and I blackened my face and made it to look like a derelict. And I went out. And I sat on the corner. I was in a state of zikr. I just kept saying Allah, Allah, and I just didn't. In the beginning, it was very uncomfortable. But after a while, I was somewhere else. And people, I was interested. And then I started observing, instead of thinking about myself, I started noticing what people are doing, at seeing me. Right? And some of them would, not even look at me, walk, like this, so they don't see me. They don't have to face me. Others would send their kids to give me money or food or things like this. And at the end of it, I stayed maybe a couple of hours on the street begging. And I got more and more courage. I would go to the people sitting in the cafes, Actually, go up there and stand there and have them, ignore me or look at me with disdain, get away from me, you're bothering me. The way I feel about people doing that, To me, go away. But then at the end when I walked away, I actually did pretty well. I think I got 15 pounds or something like that. I was surprised. And enough food. I got a bunch of food, for 2 days worth of food or something, But then when I was done and I was walking away and I cleaned myself up and was going home, I felt I was taller. That's the best way I can describe it. I felt I was actually standing up more than I normally stand up. I felt like something, a weight, got lifted off my back. And because I was so terrified of someone seeing me and recognizing me, or what would people think? The realization that what people think of me is so important, how I'm seen. Is so important, and the sense of shame I'm carrying in me is great, very deep. And I also found out that there's actually companies running these places. I actually found out that I was encroaching on the Romanian. That was the Romanian turf. It got scary for a while. It got scary because first a woman comes and starts yelling at me, and I don't understand a word she's saying. And then she brought a man with her, right? And he stood up. I was sitting on the ground, acting like I'm, And he was standing on top of me like this, threatening me. And I said, even if he kills me, fine, at that point, it just didn't matter. It was like I was in a different state completely. And I just ignored them. Didn't walk away, didn't do anything. I just stayed in my place. They finally gave up on me and left. Now when I see colleagues on the street, I appreciate them more. Brothers and sisters.
returning to the source of love.
Yes, and if I may, when you were saying that, yesterday we were trying to sing an Ilahi. Some of us were here late at night, and we didn't get to it, but it was, I remember this in pleasure and pain, to love we must return. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yes. Let's sing it now. Do we have our song sheets?
Are there a bunch of song sheets in there? Are there a bunch of song sheets in there?
Yeah. Not on here. Okay, well, some of us will know it anyway. Let me warm up a little bit. I came to this world with nothing at all. Naked I wandered around. If I was right, I'd call on me. How could I turn him down? The fire of love runs through your veins. The fire of love can burn. Remember this in pleasure and pain. To love Hadim was reminding me of something that was said, which is in playing with these attachments, in teasing our nafs, in depriving it, that this can be done with a light touch. You know, we're not here to punish ourselves. Take your own measure. That what that measure is and what is appropriate for you, it may change. What may seem like a great sacrifice one day might seem easy. But we have to start with where we are.
Yes.
And last night we spoke about Ibn Abbad of Ronda, his advice for this community of liberality and ease. The mystics and lovers of God who say, I may not be much, I may be weak, I may not know very much, but I place my reliance entirely on God. I keep the divine friend at my side in all states. If I'm heartbroken, I call the friend to my side. If I'm experiencing extreme joy and gratitude, I call the friend to my side. In disappointment, in grief, in times of sacrifice, in times of just feeling low and kind of out of it, I call the friend to my side. Again and again and again. And because you have that relationship, you are in relationship with something that created you, with something that has nourished you with love, with something that has given you every bit of your intelligence, your creativity, your liveliness. It all comes from that source. It didn't come from you. You didn't create it. You didn't develop it except in this relationship. So you can depend on that. And that's why Rumi sometimes presents the lover as a kind of helpless fool. You know, but the helpless fool, like, what is it? God protects children and drunks. But the love drunk, in this case, is the one who is moving towards that reliance on the divine. At the same time, we are people of knowledge. We are acquiring, and on this path, in this tradition, we're always working in the field of knowledge. What is knowledge? Knowledge is the knowing what is. What is? Is it just this physical level of reality, this time, space, material continuum. No, there are levels of reality. That's also part of knowledge. And your familiarity and experience with those levels of reality is part of your knowledge. So our knowledge consists also of a certain metaphysical understanding, which is different than theology or doctrine or belief. It's an orientation within reality. It's understanding the mechanics of reality. What is the soul? What is consciousness and awareness? And what is will? What is freedom? But then there's knowledge. But then there's wisdom. What is wisdom? Does anybody have... would like to offer? Okay. Mahmood or Hadim, we'll start here. What is wisdom? There are many answers, so it's unlikely you'll give a completely wrong one and totally shame yourself in front of me.
Yes, very likely.
Unlikely.
Wisdom is something that comes from the divine that is all-encompassing and is full of the attributes of the divine being that are accessible in any moment in which we turn, and that there is a reliance on that, and that we can trust in it. And the verification, it doesn't... From knowledge, oftentimes we need verification, and in the wisdom, it flows to us, and the verification is no longer, it's not necessary, because we've aligned ourselves with that friend at all times and in all moments.
Beautiful, very comprehensive. Mahmood, would you like to offer some definition of wisdom?
Wisdom is knowing what is true to me. What is true.
All right. Beautiful. And I will give a slightly different spin on it and say, if knowledge is knowing what is, wisdom is knowing the value of something. That's simple. Thank you all. It's time for lunch. Salaam alaikum.